Hi, good afternoon, everyone. Today we are here with another episode of Research with NJ, and today we have Mr. Mayank Jain. So Mayank has worked in three different economic think tanks, and he started with National Institute of Public Finance and Policy, and then he went on to work with Indian Council for Research on International Economic Relations. And currently he's working in Development Planning Center of Institute of Economic Growth. So hi Mayank, how are you doing today?
Hi Naman, I'm very well. Thanks for having me.
I think you've worked in Tilburg University for your master's on your research. Tell us something about that experience. I mean, to start with this episode, I mean, like, we want to talk about certain aspects of monopsony. I think that is your dissertation broadly, and then probably we'll touch down on convergence and then complexity economics. You started with working on monopsony in your dissertation at Tilburg University. Tell us something about that, please.
Right. So I went to Tilburg University for my master's in economics in the Netherlands. And my dissertation, like you mentioned there, was on this idea called monopsony. And monopsony is the other side of the coin. We've all heard the word monopoly, which means that there's a single seller of something. Monopsony is the opposite, where there's a single buyer of something. And most often this concept is used in the context of labor markets, because there are few employers but many potential employees. So the buyer of labor is usually a single employer or a few, a small number of employers in a particular industry, if that industry is in fact concentrated in that sense. So my thesis was on trying to find out whether there's some link between monopsony and income inequality. And I used data from the United States to examine this question.
Oh, that wasn't on India. I mean, why so?
It was very hard to find data on India at that time. And also because I had very little time to write my thesis. So I went the easy route. Although I would like to extend that work to apply that to India. I'm very interested in that. But that time I didn't have time. So I used data from the United States. So, I was interested in finding out whether monopsony can explain income inequality to whatever extent.
And what did you find out?
And I found out, so I began with the hypothesis that monopsony would be positively correlated with income inequality, which means that if there's higher monopsony, there would be higher income inequality. Because what monopsony allows employers to do is suppress wages. So, in the canonical mainstream way of modeling the labor market, the way wages are set is that people are paid according to their productivity.
Okay.
And now there are different ways to model that. Now there are more advanced ways to do that. But generally the framework is that people are paid equal to their productivity.
So how is that the concept of higher how do you decide a monopsony is higher or lower? How do you recognize that?
Yeah, there's a couple of ways to do that. So one way to do that is to estimate the elasticity of labor supply with respect to wage.
Okay.
So what that assumption of people being paid equal to their productivity does is that if they're being paid even 1 cent or 1 rupee less than their than that wage,
yeah,
they will all leave.
Okay.
So the assumption is that the labor supply curve to the firm is infinitely elastic.
Okay.
But that is not the case necessarily in real life.
But which is where monopsony comes in. Because it's based on assumptions, so we have to consider the scenario. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
Of course.
And yeah. There are now more sophisticated ways of modeling this interaction between employers and employees.
Okay.
But generally, this is the sort of.
But in monopsony scenario, I mean, this is probably one of them.
Yes, monopsony enters when you don't have an infinitely elastic, labor supply.
Okay.
So what happens is that the idea behind monopsony is that there are frictions in the labor market.
What sort of frictions?
So frictions could mean frictions about commuting. So for example, if I'm a researcher wanting to work in the think tank space, it is not true that I'll be willing to work at any think tank.
Absolutely.
Right? I would have my own preferences.
Sure.
Then I would have preferences about where the location of the think tank is.
Oh, yeah.
Maybe I don't want to commute for 2 hours. Then once I'm in a particular job, it's hard for me to leave this for another job because there's a lot of uncertainty involved.
Okay.
Right?
Okay, that
way. So there are frictions in the labor market. The labor market is not frictionless.
Okay.
Right?
Yes.
So that's where the elasticity of my supply of labor in response to a change in wage is not infinite. So if my employer decides to cut my salary, chances are that it'll take me some time to find a new job.
Absolutely.
Or even decide to look for another job, right? If my preferences are strong enough, if my loyalty is strong enough, for example.
Okay.
So that's where monopsony comes into play, because that allows employers to pay workers less than their productivity. And so what happened was, when this monopsony sort of research started, it's been around for a long time, but around 2015, 2016, around that time, it really started taking off again, this literature.
Okay.
There were new papers almost every month. So, and most of
was these papers in India, like based on Indian researchers or Indian research, or they were for Western?
For Western research, because there's more data available there.
Okay.
And
so,
there have been some papers recently on India, but the sort of number is very small.
Okay. So what sort of data, will that monopsony will correlate to?
Right. So there are two ways of identifying monopoly from data. One is estimating the labor supply elasticity.
Absolutely.
The way you do that, at least from what I know, is there's something called linked employer-employee data sets in, at least in Western countries, where you can track individuals over different occupations over time.
Okay.
So that data has sort of indicators which you can use to estimate the labor supply elasticity.
Perfect.
Then there's the other way, which is to measure the concentration in the labor market. So for example, and this is borrowed from IO literature, industrial organization.
Okay.
Where you have ways of measuring the concentration of a particular industry.
Yeah.
So that's traditionally been used to measure or identify monopolies.
Okay.
But
that is for sellers, and then when you correlate
yes.
to buyers, it becomes monopsony.
Yes.
Okay.
So a similar idea was borrowed, where you try and measure the concentration using different things. Like there's the most popular one is the Herfindahl-Hirschman index,
okay.
HHI.
Okay.
Which is a rough way to measure how concentrated a particular industry is.
Okay.
So you can sort of measure monopsony that way also. Although there's a lot of debate going on whether that's an appropriate way or not. But these are the two ways.
Of course,
I mean,
economics is full of debates
yeah.
about the way we measure things.
Right.
I mean, we couldn't still find the best possible way to, the most true way to measure poverty. I mean, forget about any other thing. And poverty is such a, relevant and most
right.
one of the most important concepts or like indicators of, many things
right.
in economics. So, I mean, we can't even think about monopsony at this moment. So, yeah, what we have is what we have.
Yeah.
And we have to rely on that and take measures and take, mitigating factors based on those measurements.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, HHI index is a good one. But then, we are limited to that.
Yeah,
so far we are limited to that, and
yeah.
we probably hope so in future we'll have some other measurement.
Yeah, hopefully
measuring
we
index.
Have,
yeah.
We have linked employer-employee data sets as well
yeah.
in the future.
But then, what is the closest data set available in India to work on monopsony?
I am very interested in that question. That's a great question. I would say perhaps the PLFS, Periodic Labor Force Survey,
okay.
which the government carries out. That's a quarterly survey. I think there might be ways, there might be variables in that data set through which you can try and approach measuring monopsony.
Mm-hmm.
I know there's a paper which uses the ASI, Annual Survey of Industries,
yeah.
to do this research for India. Of course, then there's private companies like CMIE and CEIC, which... I'm not sure, very sure about how, I've not looked very deeply into their data sets, but that's also, if someone is interested in this research, they could perhaps look into this.
Yeah, I mean, I know for a fact that IAG has very good database, very good library of databases, and they have subscriptions for very, very good databases.
Right.
So they might be handy in this sort of research, in monopsony research. But then, of course, I mean, the reliability of those data sets are not been verified by the government itself, right?
Yeah.
So it brings us to the basic question again, that what sort of data that we have in our Indian diaspora that we need to, you know, like where we can address monopsony and right. how we can address monopsony.
Right.
Because India is a big country, you know, and it's full of industries,
right.
factories and everything. And surely, and it's a basically labor intensive country, right?
Mm.
So, of course, monopsony should be existing in this thing, right? Where there would be one buyer, most probably not, but then yeah, there would be some sort
exactly.
of
exactly. And I think as Indians, we intuitively understand this because we feel like you know, we don't have any power when it comes to interacting with an employer.
Absolutely.
We feel like there are 100 people
standing behind
me.
Yeah.
So I better sort of hold on to this
yes.
opportunity. So I think people in monopsony is a reality, definitely.
Oh, yes, it is. I am not disputing that, and nobody should. I mean, like.
But it'd be very interesting to sort of actually measure it and see it in research.
Because because we don't have the literature, the right amount of literature, or like right amount of interest from the, you know, no renowned researchers, doesn't mean that the concept does not exist for this country or any other country.
Right.
It is there. It does happen.
Yeah.
And there is a reason that competition law is there. Right?
Exactly.
So Competition Act is there. So, I mean, there is a reason that it was established by the Ministry of Corporate Affairs, right? So, I mean, again, I mean, like, because monopsony in terms of India is a very, 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 very big question, because India is a very big economy and it's a very promising economy. And surely in many sectors, industrial sectors, monopsony would be existing. And probably, I would probably assume that in every sector it would be there, but the right question for any researcher would be how it occurs, it exists, and how we can measure it so that we can, you know, like provide some mitigating implications, policy implications towards it, or to, you know, like to eliminate monopsony and to get back our economy to the most normal levels and to the true levels. But yeah, I mean, again, yeah, go on. I mean, please tell us more about your dissertation on that research.
Right. So I wanted to find out whether there's a link between monopsony and income inequality.
Yeah.
And I began the thesis with the hypothesis that they'll be positively correlated. So if there's higher monopsony, that means there's more possibility of wage suppression, which would increase inequality,
okay.
especially if it's acting on one end of the income distribution. But what I found out was the opposite, which is why research can be so interesting, right? Because it challenges your beliefs and
oh, yeah,
it can give a completely different conclusion to what you thought you would get. So what I found was that there's an inverse relation between monopsony and income inequality. And the way that acts is that by reducing the dispersion in the income distribution, which ultimately reduces inequality. So for example, one way of understanding this is a company town. So in India, we have cities like Jamshedpur or Rourkela, where there were steel plants. And these cities were set up to house the employees in these steel factories, managers, workers, etc. What happens is, if there's, and this is an extreme example to just illustrate how this works. What happens is, if there's one company setting wages for a particular labor market, then chances are that the wages will not be as dispersed, right? Because there's the sort of decision making when it comes to setting wages
is coming
from one source.
Of course.
Right?
I mean, if one source has to make decisions, of course, there would be some sort of loopholes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it ends up reducing inequality. As opposed to, let's say, a major metropolitan city like Delhi or Mumbai
yeah.
or Bangalore, where there's a lot of employers, there's a huge variety of employers, inequality ends up increasing because there's a lot of sort of the sources of wages are very different.
Different, of course.
So monopsony, what I found was a correlation. I didn't find a causal relation. But I found an association between increased monopsony and reduced income inequality.
Okay.
I also found out that this effect is not equal depending on the industry. So I looked at whether this effect is stronger for goods producing industries or service providing industries.
Okay.
And this effect is stronger for goods producing industries. So yeah, that's what
so, I mean, I have a very interesting question right now, because I actually work on input output tables, and then I try to construct social accounting matrices. And in social accounting matrices, we use input output tables as one part of it. And then like that part is basically either product by product or industry by industry. So we generally use product by product, right? Because that's the most used model, basically, because of the assumptions, right? And then when we construct a social accounting matrix, that is SAM, we use income distribution data. Okay. So would that help? Like, would that be one way to, you know, like measure monopsony or find any sort of thing from that about monopsony? Surely we can do for monopoly, right? And we do understand that it does not exist. It won't be able to exist.
You can perhaps, using that sort of data, you can maybe construct something like an HHI, something that measures the concentration. But since in that data you don't have data about individuals, it might be hard to estimate the labor supply elasticity. So you can go the other route, where you estimate the concentration of an industry and that how that relates to monopsony.
And then verifying it through SAM.
Verifying it through SAM, yes.
Because the income distribution for the households, right? So that's how I'm trying to target this. Trying to understand, like, would that be possible?
Definitely. The sort of you have data on firms, right?
Yes,
and you
absolutely.
Also have data
yes,
on
yes.
Individuals.
Yeah, we do.
CGM, right?
Not CGM. Sorry, CGM is the next step of SAM. So okay. I'm just limiting myself to SAM.
Okay, so in
because
SAM,
CGM is basically the programming version of SAM itself.
Okay, right? Okay. So yeah, I think with this kind of data, it's possible to construct a measure of concentration and then use that to then determine monopsony.
All right. So I just want to, you know, like move forward with another topic, that would be convergence. And I think after monopsony, and, you know, definitely would like to converge two economies to understand what exactly happens between them. A poor economic growth country and a fast moving economy. So how does that correlate, and what exactly is convergence? I mean, I know it's not that a fresh concept. It's been around, but then there are not many good literature, I would say. There are papers and there are some good research being conducted, but they have not been published yet. So what would be your take on that?
Right. So convergence is something that I'm working on currently with Dr. Sabyasachi Kar at IEG. And Dr. Debajit Jha at Jindal Global University. And it's like you said, it's a very old topic. The question is actually very interesting. People began this work by thinking, can poor countries catch up to rich countries? And since then, there's a big body of literature which this has spawned. And sort of a big theoretical literature as well, which is the Solow model, which every student of economic studies. The sort of this literature on convergence began to basically test whether the Solow model or whether these models of growth are actually true in terms of what they're in terms of the predictions they're making, or how they're describing the reality of the movement of countries.
So would you suggest any bachelor's degree program student or any master's degree program student to study convergence, to have convergence included into their curriculum or syllabi?
Absolutely. I think it's in a way it's already included, because everyone studies the Solow model even in undergrad. But yes, some more background and some more sort of, it can be perhaps framed better to make it more exciting. But I think everyone intuitively has an affinity towards this question. You know, everyone wants their country to do well.
Absolutely.
So I think people would be interested in understanding whether poor countries can catch up towards rich ones.
Oh, yes.
And so the work we're doing the work that I did with Professor Sabyasachi Kar and Professor Debajit Jha was a very specific question. It addressed a very specific question, which was that in India, we see that this convergence literature was going in two different directions. What this literature said was that at the state level in India, there was divergence. That states were diverging in terms of their per capita incomes, but districts were converging.
Okay.
So we were trying to find a way to explain why this might happen, because this is a pretty counterintuitive result.
It's a very precise observation. I mean, very, very precise observation. I mean, like, in terms of states, I mean, in terms of when we talk about states, they are diverging. And when it comes down to a more narrow, analysis, the districts, they're converging. And we all know that districts compile to become a state, right? So when we talk about a group of districts taken together, so and compare it with the other set of districts, right?
One would imagine that if the lower units are converging, then
Converging
the
mean
upper
why
units are
well,
also
should be
converging.
converging in some way or the other, but in fact it's totally opposite. It's diverging. It's a very interesting like literature or your observation. It's a very precise observation, and congratulations to you on this thing. I mean, yeah, please go on and explain. I mean, like, what sort of findings were there with this thing?
So to do that, I'll have to give some background.
Absolutely.
So the way convergence was measured earlier, and it still is, there are two ways basically. One is called beta convergence, which you basically conduct a regression. You regress the growth rate of a panel on the initial level of income or per capita income in that panel, and basically you find that countries that began with a lower level of income grew faster, right? And that happens because of increasing returns to capital when you're at a lower level of income. And then there are also, theoretically, there are assumptions that lower income countries can borrow technology from already developed countries and
All
stuff
right.
like that. So this was beta convergence. Now the literature developed to a point where people started realizing that even if you have convergence being displayed in that aggression, that doesn't necessarily mean that countries are coming closer together over time in terms of their income. Then people did sigma convergence, which is basically measure the coefficient of variation of
Is
the
there
panel
any
over
alpha
time.
conversions that we are missing about?
No.
Because surely people would love to understand, like, why there is beta and then sigma and where we're lacking alpha or gamma, right?
There is no explanation for why people use particular symbols for there is an alpha in the beta regressions, but that's just the constant. Sorry, that's my very geeky way of answering that question. So then people sort of figured out that beta convergence is not sufficient. It may be necessary, but it's not sufficient. So you also need a measure of the spread of the data. So that's how people started using sigma convergence. Now the problem with both these approaches is that they assume that over time countries will converge to a single point,
And
a
one.
single equilibrium, a steady state. But what can actually happen in reality is you can have multiple equilibriums.
Absolutely.
So if you imagine a bell curve of per income distributions of countries, plausibly, what can happen over time, right? Some poor countries can become rich, and poor
Absolutely.
countries can become poor, rich countries can become poor,
Yeah, depending on
right?
the scenarios, yeah, of
Depending
course.
on what happens. Then some rich countries will stay rich, and some poor countries will stay poor, right?
Absolutely.
And some countries that are close together in the distribution, they can separate out into different parts of the distribution,
Absolutely,
right?
yes.
So what that does is your distribution, your bell curve, will end up having multiple peaks and multiple equilibria.
Yes, of course.
And beta convergence and sigma convergence cannot account for those multiple equilibriums because they're averages. A regression is an average.
Absolutely.
So an average cannot tell you how a distribution evolves over time, particularly if that distribution has multiple peaks over time. So that's where you have things like distribution dynamics, where you just study the distribution over time. But you also have something called club convergence, which means that countries sort of
With a
there
similar convergence or distribution,
are... Right.
you club them and then you try to analyze with the other one.
Yeah, so clubs form by their own. So as countries develop, there are some countries that will come close to each other, but that group may not be close to another group.
Another group, of course. Yeah, right? That's what I mean.
So countries can converge towards clubs, and these groups get formed, which is where the which is where you have things like the middle income trap.
Okay.
Where some countries are in have achieved middle income, but they're not able to get out of that.
Get out of
so
that.
They're stuck in that equilibrium.
Probably, I guess India would qualify for that some sort of way.
Yeah.
Even though India is a high performing economy.
Yes, it's a very fast growing economy and it's a big economy.
But then we still are stated into middle or low income categories.
Then you need statistical techniques that can account for these multiple equilibrium. So we used a methodology developed by Phillips and Sewell. It's a 2007 paper, which on panel data, it allows for all scenarios: absolute convergence, absolute divergence, and club convergence.
Club convergence. Okay.
So using that, we found that there's actually no contradiction in India.
Okay.
We have states converging towards different clubs and we have districts converging towards different clubs.
Okay.
So there is no counterintuitive result.
Balance basically between states converging and states diverging and districts converging, right? Okay.
Actually, so what we found that this puzzle came up because people were using inappropriate frameworks to analyze this. So club convergence framework is better. Look into this issue.
So has this paper been made public or like sort of published or
not yet?
Not yet. Okay. So, all right. And that's interesting because we don't generally get people to talk about an unpublished work so far, something that is not made public. But there is a working paper, right?
We're in the process of publishing a working paper.
Yeah.
We're not doing something radically new. We're just answering a very specific question.
Probably a precise observation. I mean, many good researchers might miss, right?
Exactly.
With the sort of data that is there in India. I mean, it is very easy to, you know, to miss that observation. Yeah. So, I mean, again, I congratulate you on you.
I would give full credit to my supervisor who's been working on this. Both my supervisors who've been working on this for a long time.
I mean, absolutely. I mean, whosoever is due for this, for this congratulation, for this credit. But yes, of course, I mean, because this is a very, very precise observation. I mean, most of us would miss this thing. So, I mean, yes. I mean, there is there is actually some good quality work being conducted. Yeah.
Right. I mean, thank you.
But I mean, which lets us to move on to our last segment of topics, that would be complexity economics. It's a very debatable topic at this moment, and it's a very upcoming topic, probably the future of economics. Probably, we're not sure yet, but yes, one can make that assumption that it's a future of economics. Please tell us something about it, because, I mean...
Sure.
I work on CGM and it completely disregards CGM's assumptions. So, I mean, I'm interested to know what exactly is complexity economics.
Right. So, there's a bit of history here,
which
I'll just give your listeners a little bit of background. So, people in sort of popular discourse, people criticize economics by saying that there are unrealistic assumptions in economic models, right? But what is not popularly known is why those assumptions are used in the first place.
Yeah.
Now, generally, models are abstractions by definition, right? You cannot represent the real world in a model with all of the facets of the real world.
Oh, yes.
You have to boil things down to the essentials.
Essentials.
So that you can get useful insights.
Yes, because... Right? Because economics is so real time and it's so dynamic that it changes at a pace that we can't even imagine.
Yes.
As we speak, you know, the dynamics of economics is changing.
Right.
I mean, right.
And that's a very interesting point. I'll come back to this again.
Because because we think that this particular factor will change. Hello to you guys, because it's not.
Hmm.
There are thousands and thousands of factors, parameters, variables that change simultaneously.
Right.
So we cannot model each and every of them. So then there comes ceteris paribus.
Yes.
Other things being equal, let's take one at a time.
Right.
And then start to model things up. Yeah,
so
please, please.
Reality is very complex and it's hard to create a formal mathematical model of that reality, which is why you have to, which is why assumptions like rational expectations and equilibriums
yes.
were introduced.
Yeah.
Right. Now, the thing is that you don't necessarily need to have a tractable or solvable model in order to be able to model reality.
Yeah.
Now, with the since we have computers now and very powerful computers, what you can do is simulate the real world and create something called agent-based models.
Okay.
And this has already been being done in other sciences like physics.
Oh yes.
Or biology, ecology,
engineering, of course,
even traffic and urban planning, weather forecasting.
Yes.
So these disciplines use the benefit of technology to create models that did not require strict very strong assumptions.
Yeah.
In economics, this is being done in the subfield of
complexity
economics, where the tools and techniques of complexity sciences are applied to questions of economics.
All right.
So what complex is, there's no singular definition for complex systems, but there are certain principles, which are that you have a lot of heterogeneous agents interacting with each other.
Okay.
And that interaction produces outcomes that are not necessarily linear. So you cannot add up outcomes for each agent and then arrive at a macro outcome.
Okay.
Right? Which is different from traditional...
general equilibrium theory.
Not necessarily equilibrium, but about sort of linearity and
okay.
sort of adding up things. So, for example, to take an example from science, a water droplet is made from the sort of the chemical makeup is H2O, right?
Yes.
Two atoms of hydrogen and one of oxygen,
yes.
right? Now, the properties of hydrogen and oxygen atoms are very different when you take them separately.
Of course.
But
because
when you combine them, you create something completely different that does not, so the sum is more than the whole
it's,
is more than the sum
like,
of its parts.
I mean, when it comes to H2O, it's not like just because that we're combining two parts of hydrogen and one part of oxygen will always give you water. Yeah, that's the
right.
composition, that's the formulation,
right.
but then it won't every time just because you pick two part and then that's the understanding of how what the formula of like what's the chemical formula of water that is H2O.
Right.
Right. But yeah,
right.
I mean, I get the point
right.
that we're trying to, you know.
Yeah. To give another example.
Yeah.
Our brain has neurons.
Absolutely.
Right? A neuron is actually a very simple thing.
Yes.
It takes a signal and gives an output.
Output.
Right.
Yeah.
When millions of neurons are connected to each other, there's something else is created entirely.
Yeah,
there is emergence of a consciousness of a
absolutely.
Human being.
Yes.
With feelings, with thoughts.
Yes.
With creativity, with dreams. Right. You cannot reduce that down to its micro components.
Micro, yes.
So the macro is not necessarily adding up the micro.
Micros, yes, yes.
The,
that's
the,
what I'm trying
yeah.
to say with the H2O example.
Right.
Just because we know that H2O is water does not mean that every time we combine two parts of hydrogen and one part of oxygen
yeah.
will always result in.
Yeah.
It's not the atomic level. It's a whole composition
exactly.
stuff,
exactly.
right?
So this is called emergence.
Okay.
Where sort of phenomena emerge from the interaction of
micros
from the at the micro scale, and the macro scale looks completely
different. Different.
It's
yes.
not necessarily
yes.
an adding up
I mean,
of the
I
micro.
Also, I mean, I completely agree what you're trying to tell me and the listeners that, and I believe the same thing. The microeconomics tells us something else. And the macroeconomics tell us something.
Right.
Just because macro is aggregated does not mean that it is aggregated based on the microeconomics
yes.
part.
Yeah.
Right. It's totally different.
Right.
Right.
Although sort of in traditional macro models like DSG models, as far as I know, I could be wrong, but from whatever I've read, That is how the macroeconomy is modeled by adding up the micros, which is where you have representative agents.
Yeah, but it's not actually true. When we check it through different sort of reality and, you know, the data that we get, it does not add up.
Right.
It's like a misnomer aspect of microeconomics and macroeconomics into it, right? Yeah.
They don't even have to be separate
also, necessarily. Yeah.
So that's emergence is one property of complex systems. The other is just sensitivity to initial conditions. So you can have a completely different outcome depending on where you started from.
That is more appropriate in terms of a climate change or weather, mapping weather, forecasting weather on that stuff, right? And trying to understand when and where the extreme events might and might not take place. I would say that.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
And you have, makes sense. You have sort of agents at the micro scale that are interacting with each other.
Yes.
And these things are very hard to model in a mathematical
model. Yeah, of course. I mean, if you can model, then you become the god. I mean, probably you will be termed as the god.
And
when
you introduce things like non-linearities and emergence and all these things, sometimes these models are not even solvable.
Absolutely.
So that is where you have to use computers to simulate, artificially generate societies.
It's just about trying to understand what probably the possible scenario be.
Yeah.
Right.
So what agent-based modeling in complexity economics does is, using the help of computers, you decide, and it's not completely divorced from economic theory.
Yeah.
You, if you want to decide how you want your agents to behave in your agent-based model, you have to rely on the theory that's been built up. So, for example, you can have things like rational expectations in an agent-based model. You can have other insights from behavioral economics, which says that rationality is bounded.
Bounded, yes.
And you sort of program your agents to behave a certain way and interact a certain way. And then you let the system run on the computer.
Right.
And that generates outcomes that you can observe over time.
Okay.
And then you match it, you take it to data and see how realistic your model is.
Model is, of course.
Right?
Yeah.
So this agent-based modeling makes it very easy to have heterogeneous agents. It makes it easy to have interactions. And it also allows for things like emergence and non-linearities. So I feel it's a very promising area.
It is promising, and I'm very interested in it. It's totally forecasting. Forecasting can be wrong. But then, yes, of course, I mean, that's the closest we have gone so far in economics, right?
Right. And also, I'll say one sort of disadvantage about using these models is that...
Would this translate to the disadvantage of complexity economics? Or it's just the assumptions or the models that we use in this context?
Which disadvantage?
That you're trying to tell us.
Disadvantage is about, complexity economics and agent-based models general.
Yeah.
So agent-based models are not generally structural.
Yes.
So they're not as rich as traditional models that have been developed in economics till now. So you don't really have things like counterfactuals, which you can have in a structural model. They're also very hard to calibrate, because that sort of data, micro data, is very hard to find.
Yes.
Even in Western countries.
Yes.
But with the sort of advent of things like big data, where you have like data on credit card transactions, on point of sale transactions, it's becoming slightly easier to sort of work with this data.
Just trying to work with the technology that is available and the sort of resources that we have, and trying to model, trying to bring it all into one place, that is economics, and specifically to complexity economics.
Right.
So we can transcend that.
Yeah. So this is hopefully, I am very interested in this field, and I would want to work on these things. I would want to work on complexity economics and use agent-based models. But at the same time, I would like to work on combining their insights with insights from mainstream. Canonical insights.
Yeah.
I think that would give us some wonderful research. And I hope to see more of it in the future.
Oh, absolutely. And what is your take on CBDC? Central Bank Digital Currency.
I did work on them for a little bit while I was at NIPFP.
Okay.
To be fair, I have forgotten a lot of the theory about...
I mean, I'm just asking a general question. Like, what's your take on CBDC? Like, do you think it's good for country? I mean, it's good for the economy in terms of monetary policy? Just a simple background.
Well, the real answer is I don't know. I think since you're working on...
Oh, yeah, I am actually... I am working on this, basically. But then, Yeah, I mean, like, we struggling a lot because it's a very fairly new concept and something that will take, you know, like a year or so just to have some sort of data, at least, you know, some sort of data, at least have that minimum, you know, sample sized data.
Right.
To understand what would happen and what will happen.
Right.
Right. So
one thing I would say is that I think a country should be very clear in its objectives about why they want to
CBDC. That has been the problem. That has been the problem, so, because there is a lot of if and buts that if we do this, if we do that.
So people want monetary policy benefits. They want financial
They want
financial inclusion.
And then they want trade also. So
trade.
There is no room for compromise. Right. Some sort of, because, you know, like, trade happens when two countries are involved, two or three countries are involved. Mm-hmm. But if none of them are willing to step down or compromise, then where is the possibility? So it's a challenging sort of area right now, CBDC. It's a challenging introduction to a different form of currency.
Right.
So,
and generally, I'm a little skeptical of always using new technology to solve things.
Yes, absolutely. I haven't started using Paytm or UPI or Bharat Pay myself because I am not sure, I'm not confident in those technologies because I've had the, from my family, I mean, I know that payments get stuck. Right. So you
But that's slightly different, which is like for personal
use. Yeah, absolutely.
What I mean is that to solve public policy issues, I don't think you should always go for a new this is my personal opinion. I don't think you can always layer a new technology to solve issues that are fundamentally arising out of a lack of state
capacity
or a lack of sound public policy making. So I think you should get your basics right first.
Absolutely. I mean, that's
and then
right. That's right.
Think of using new technology.
At
the very least, keep working on your basics at the same time.
I've had questions people asking me, you know, like, we have Paytm, we have UPI, we have all sort of digital payment. Why do we need digital currency? I mean, we already have. I mean, like, come on, guys. I mean, that is a medium to pay for an article or a service, right? Or for a good or something. But this is a form of currency. Currency and a medium to pay are totally different.
Right.
We are changing the form. I mean, you can pay, but ultimately there is an account at the back end, right?
Right.
But now we are changing that account to the digital currency part, right? There is no physical cash or coin involved in it. You can just pay it through digitally.
Right.
But paying digitally through Paytm or something, that is that you're transferring money from your account to the other
from
account.
One bank to another.
One bank to another. One account to another. But in this thing, there is no physical visibility of any cash or coins or anything. It's just totally digital currency.
Right.
So, I mean, it's an interesting topic, but yeah, we're struggling a lot. But let's see how we come up with things. We've given ourselves some time to think about it. And yeah, it's very freshly because, I mean, the implementation is still a pilot project, right? So, we are also holding our hands and, you know, thoughts.
Right. It's a very new field. So, every most central banks in the world are figuring this out.
Because people who have started this fully functional, but those countries are Caribbean countries. And even though they have, but they have had their share of problems.
Right.
Fair share of problems, and they are trying to rectify because, you know, there is whole new infrastructure involved in it.
Right.
That is absolutely digital.
Right.
Not just the infrastructure, computers, labor, who's monitoring, and the sort of coding, the blockchain based, everything. I mean, it's fairly new.
Which is
concept.
Why you need to get your basics right.
Basic
because
rights.
You're also making yourself vulnerable to cyber attacks.
Absolutely.
And especially cyber attacks on a currency note.
Currency notes. Yes.
So
that's a big, big challenge. And India is a big economy. So is US and UK, Europe, France, if you specifically Germany, Australia, China. And Middle East, because Middle East is a big, big economy. I mean, in terms of money and the price positions they have, the wells and golds, who doesn't want them? But yeah, I mean, digital currency will change the outlook of this monetary policies and the sort of the way we handle currency. But again, it's fairly new. But we're giving our thoughts. We're trying to hold our vision and mission into it.
Right.
Yeah, we'll stay apart and then see where we go.
I hope your paper
comes out soon and helps us understand this issue. That would be absolutely forecasting, you know, futuristic about what will happen. But let's see how it goes and let's see where we come near to it. Yeah, anyway, thank you so much, Mayank, for your insights on your, you know, monopsony, convergence and complexity economics. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Naman. Thanks
thank
for
you.
Having me.
Thank you, guys.